From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Senator Trent Lott. The Republican from Mississippi is the former House and Senate whip, as well as former Senate Majority Leader. He's written a new memoir about his more than three decades in politics called Herding Cats. We'll talk about whether he thinks the Bush administration's arguments for war were misleading, and we'll talk about his relationship with President Clinton and his role in the Senate impeachment trial. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new DVD box set of The Dick Cavett Show that collects interviews from the late 60s and early 70s with rock stars, including Janis Joplin, the Jefferson Airplane, and David Bowie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Trent Lott, Republican senator from Mississippi, the former House and Senate whip, and former Senate Majority Leader. Lott was forced out of his position as Senate Majority Leader at the end of 2002 after making a controversial toast in praise of Senator Strom Thurmond at a celebration of Thurmond's 100th birthday. Senator Bill Frist took over as Majority Leader. Trent Lott has written a new memoir about his more than three decades in Congress called Herding Cats. Trent Lott, welcome to Fresh Air. In your book, you write about President Bush and the war in Iraq, and you say, in the summer of 2002, even as the first moves on a new Homeland Security Department were underway, the president began lobbying for an open-ended resolution empowering him to wage war on Iraq. Bush made clear his intentions to wage war in Iraq in several of our private meetings. But as late summer rolled around, I didn't feel the administration was moving toward this goal with the decisiveness that would be needed to sell Congress. When the president first started talking with you about Iraq, how did he raise it? What did he say?
It probably came up originally in the early morning breakfast that the leadership from the House and Senate, Republican, Democrat, had with the president almost weekly, beginning in the fall of 2001. And when we would have those breakfasts, right at 7 o'clock, we'd walk in and sit down, and he would take about 15 minutes to sort of go around the world and tell us what was happening, what the terrorist information was, and what was going on in different countries. I suspect that it first started coming up probably in 2002, his growing concern about Saddam Hussein and Iraq, possibility of weapons of mass destruction, and also in my one-on-one conversations, it was evident to me that he had a real concern about Iraq. And clearly by the summer, the movement was going in the direction of a direct action against that country. So it came up, throughout 2002, but by the end of August, I could see that they were going to be seeking this resolution, and I made a call to the vice president, which I said, Mr. Vice President, I think you have to do a better job of making the case here. The American people don't quite understand what's at stake here.
Yes, you say that in the book, and then you say that Cheney said to you, we're about to fix that. And you're right,
yes.
Cheney played the nuclear card. Cheney said, we know that Saddam has resumed his efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. Many of us are convinced that he will acquire nuclear weapons fairly soon. Now, that turned out to not be true. And I'm wondering if when you write this in the book, are you saying that Cheney said this just to get support for the war, or that, you know, Cheney really believed it when he said it? I'm not sure whether you're saying that Cheney played you and the rest of the nation just to get support for the war.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I was getting a lot of the same intelligence briefings that the president, the vice president, were getting in my leadership role, and then, of course, subsequently as a member of the Intelligence Committee. We had all kinds of reasons to believe and to think that they did have weapons of mass destruction, not just nuclear. And, of course, there was the famous yellow cake issue, the information that Saddam had tried to get this, material, which could be used for the manufacture of nuclear weapons from Africa. I think, obviously, they used that issue to try to make their case, but I think it was based on information that we were getting from our intelligence community and from intelligence community and Britain and France and Germany.
Do you feel, looking back, that the Bush administration listened to intelligence information they were getting in on a very selective basis? For example, the whole yellow cake thing. Joe Wilson came back from his trip to Niger and said, no evidence that Saddam Hussein tried to buy yellow cake here. And there were people within the CIA who were critical of what the president was doing. He was getting information that was more skeptical about weapons of mass destruction, but he didn't necessarily give that the same weight that he was giving. I mean, obviously, he did not give it the same weight he was giving other information he was getting. So do you feel that he listened selectively to his—
Perhaps he did.
Uh-huh.
And don't we all? I mean, we listen or we hear what many times we want to hear. Maybe they and us were all putting too much weight on some of the information we were being given. But the accumulation clearly was something. I think if you're going to place blame somewhere, I'd put it on the intelligence community. In direct answer to your question, perhaps they, the administration, and we, me included, were listening selectively. But we were being given a lot of material that was very scary, and we had evidence of things that happened in the past that led you to believe, well, this is credible.
First, the Bush administration talked about weapons of mass destruction, and there haven't been any found yet. Then the administration said we needed to fight terrorists over there so that we didn't have to fight them over here. Many experts have since said that our invasion of Iraq has made Iraq a magnet for terrorists from Iraq and from other countries as well, and that it's training at least as many people, or close to as many people, as al-Qaeda had trained in camps in Afghanistan. And in terms of not having to fight them over here, you know, London, our ally in the invasion, you know, was attacked last month. Do you think that that was now a credible reason to invade Iraq, to fight terrorists over there so that we wouldn't have to fight them over here?
The terrorists, homegrown apparently, Great Britain did attack in London, and of course there was the attack in Spain. But there have been attacks in countries that have not been involved in our coalition. Russia, for instance, and Egypt as another example, and in Jordan. Many of these countries have been wrestling with these terrorist attacks for years. So I do think you have to acknowledge that. Secondly, I don't think we give enough attention to the fact that we have not been attacked again since 9/11. How did that happen? Are we doing that good a job against terrorists here at home? Are the CIA and the FBI communicating better? And are they, as a matter of fact, intercepting and stopping potential threats? But, I mean, that's not an insignificant fact. You know, maybe the answer is what you said. Iraq has become a magnet for terrorists. They're in Iraq, and then maybe they're not in Casablanca or Morocco or Jordan or even France, for instance. Where would they be? Would they be here? I think to say that, look, we went into Iraq because of the terrorist attack is not a good argument. It was a factor. It was not the factor. We were concerned, or there was concern about Iraq, because of the destabilizing force they were in the region. You know all the arguments, but let me stop there because I know you. I hear another question about to come.
Oh, well, the point about saying, the magnet for terrorists thing in Iraq is that it was attracting people who hadn't yet become terrorists and turning them into terrorists. You know, and when they leave Iraq, where are they going to go?
Well, hopefully the terrorists will not leave Iraq. Where the insurgents, as they're called.
But then the people in Iraq will be stuck with all these terrorists who hadn't even been there before.
Well, perhaps they will be dealt with, or justice will be meted out in terms of dealing with them. Perhaps even they'll be caught and arrested. But we're hoping that a lot of the terrorists in Iraq will choose some other role in life, or that we'll be able to deal with them there. And by the way, our men and women in uniform are dealing with them every day. Thousands of them, and their leadership have been, either killed or taken in custody.
Do you feel that your party has become more divided now about the wisdom of the war in Iraq and about what we should do now, particularly as the unpopularity of the war seems to increase?
There's no question that there are some dissident voices within the Republican Party, just as there are in the Democratic Party. There is more division now because it has gone on a while. It hasn't, any time you continue to have the loss of life over a period of, years, people have a right to say, okay, what's the plan here? How long is this going to go on? How are we going to deal with the pressures that have been put on our troops and the National Guard and Reserve? I don't view that as a negative. I view that as American people being the American people. They're asking questions of their elected officials. I think the people have a right for us to explain what we're doing and what are the markers we're looking for. I think the president is going to be trying to do that, but I don't think it's just up to the president. I think those of us that are in elective office better be thinking about this too. And we better be asking tough questions of the Department of Defense and the CIA and the administration.
You write in your new book a little bit about how President Bush pressured you before the war in Iraq to derail Senator Biden's proposal that would have required, that would have restricted the use of force to just attacking installations of weapons of mass destruction, would have required spending more time at the UN trying to get UN support. And obviously the president really wanted you to push through congressional support for an American-led invasion. Do you have any regrets over your role in helping to lead the country toward that invasion?
No, I don't. And that would have been an easy question to, you know, say, well, maybe yes, or to go back and second guess it. But you have to, you know, look back at what you were being told at that time, look at what was going on in the world and in Iraq. I didn't feel pressured to get the Biden, Lugar, perhaps Hagel, there were two or three senators who were involved, resolution set aside. I looked at it. I didn't think it was the resolution we needed. But, you know, I was very careful to talk to Senator Lugar, that I have a great deal of respect for, and ask for his input and ask him to defer and actually to be involved with us in writing the resolution. And he was. And he didn't just walk in and say, okay, I'm going to sign on to your resolution. He had input. And look, also, you have to look back at Saddam Hussein, what he had done to his own people, what he had done to his neighbors, what a negative force he was in the region, and the information we had about weapons of mass destruction. Did we find nuclear weapons? No. Did we find huge caches of chemical, biological weapons? No. But we have found some chemical weapons, and in fact, just recently they found them. We have found thousands and thousands and hundreds of destructive weaponry that have been in these various caches around the country. Did I expect more? Yes. I really fully expected that when our troops got to the border of Baghdad that they would have to deal with chemical weapons. And that didn't happen. So I'm not proud of that fact, that we based our decision on some things that didn't turn out to be as we thought they were. But when I look back on that situation, I do think we did the right thing. I hope that we will be careful to do the right thing from now on. We need to, at some point, we're going to have to say to the Iraqis, we've helped you. Saddam Hussein is out of office. You've had a chance to form your own government and move to democracy. We've helped you get your infrastructure redone. You know, we've got to, at some point, though, say, look, it's your democracy. It's your freedom. It's your opportunity for a better life. Take it. But you've got to do it. Now, you might say, wait a minute, that sounds like you're saying that's an exit strategy or a date certain. Not necessarily. I think that you base that on conditions. But at some point, we are going to have to, pull out and let them do it for themselves.
My guest is Senator Trent Lott. His new memoir is called Herding Cats. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Senator Trent Lott. He was forced out of his position as Senate Majority Leader in late 2002 after making a controversial toast in praise of Strom Thurmond on the occasion of Thurmond's 100th birthday. Referring to Thurmond's run for president in 1948 when he was a segregationist, states' rights Dixiecrat, Lott said, "We voted for him, we're proud of it, and if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems over all these years." Bill Frist took over as Senate Majority Leader. Now, you've called Senator Frist one of the main manipulators in getting you to step down after your toast to Strom Thurmond, and you called his actions a personal betrayal. You've also said you felt that the president didn't help you when he could have. So have you paid a price for criticizing them?
Not yet. Maybe I will someday, but I don't know what the ramifications would be. I think I actually was pretty generous in the book and what I had to say about President Bush. I considered him more of a friend than the other six presidents I served with in Washington. I guess part of that's age, part of it is philosophical compatibility, but I'm very fond of the president and of Laura Bush. Was I somewhat hurt by the way events developed and what some people did do or didn't do? Sure. With regard to Senator Frist, I talk a lot in the book about the fact that once, he was leader, we talked it through. He's given me an opportunity to be in leadership positions since then, and most of the time I'm there working to try to help him move the legislative process. Some people would say, well, why would you do that if you felt like he sort of betrayed you? It's because he is the leader, and regardless of how he got there or how I got where I am, that's the fact. The reason why I felt a personal betrayal is because I did take a particular interest in him when he came to the Senate. I thought we were good friends. I was sort of an advocate for him in a number of ways, pointed him to the National Medicare Commission, encouraged him to run for chairman of the Republican Senate Campaign Committee. So I guess I was somewhat, again, maybe the better word is just hurt. But I've come to terms with all that, and I've moved on, and I hope that they will allow me to sort of give my view of what happened and then accept that. And I must say, Senator Frist's comments have been very magnanimous, even since the book has been talked about.
Would you want to be majority leader again if Senator Frist decides to leave and run for president?
I enjoyed being majority leader. It's a great position. You can do a lot to move the legislative process, work with the administration, do important things for your country and things that would affect your constituents back in your home state, in my case, Mississippi, of course, do things for your children and grandchildren. However, I've learned over the last 2 years, since 2002, you actually can shape legislation and help move legislation and be a leader without the title. I must say, I think the position of majority leader in the United States Senate is the toughest political job in Washington. The majority leader leads by the prestige of the position. He has very few controls. He has very few rewards and almost no sticks that he can apply in making the process work. And the rules are such that any senator at any time can hold things up or offer an amendment on any subject. So it's a tough job, and from that standpoint, the responsibility, the stress of the responsibility, is something that, as I look back on, I don't miss it. But all my life, Terry, I believe that whatever you do, whatever organization you're in, do your best, work hard, get involved, try to be a leader in that organization. So, I would be honored to be leader again, but it's not something I have to do in order to be able to fulfill my responsibilities as a senator.
So should we count that as a yes, you would like to be majority leader?
One of the things I've gotten in trouble about over the years is being too candid.
Is answering the questions.
Well, here's the answer is yes. I'd be honored to be majority leader again. Point blank, yes, that'd be fine. I'd love to do it. I may not even seek it because there are other good men and women that could do the job. And if I feel like we've got somebody that can do the job well, I'd probably defer to them. I had my shot. I enjoyed it. And, maybe it's time for somebody else to do that.
I want to talk with you about some of the back channels you established in Congress, but I just have one other issue of current controversy I want to talk with you about before we get there, and that's the nomination of Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. And I want to quote something that you say in the book that I was surprised to hear you say. You write, "Democrats are right when they complain about the way President Clinton's judicial nominees were handled by Republicans. We held them up in the Judiciary Committee, which was the functional equivalent of a filibuster. It was crazy, but the cycle of retribution needs to end." I confess I'm surprised to hear you say that you think what the Republicans did to Clinton's judicial nominees were the equivalent of filibusters.
I think you have to be honest about that sort of thing. You can't stand up and sanctimoniously say you're doing something wrong if, in fact, you also did something wrong, but in a different way. I was not always comfortable with what was being done in the Judiciary Committee, and I did feel like some of Clinton's nominees should have been moved faster. I've admitted that on the floor of the United States Senate. I also, when my colleagues one time wanted to filibuster a nominee from through the judiciary from California, I went to the floor of the Senate and gave a very aggressive speech saying we're not going to filibuster these nominees. But I do think that this war on the judicial nominations has been escalating up. Started with Bork, and then there's been a tit-for-tat going on until finally, it just got to where it was souring the whole institution. It had to end. I think maybe it is beginning to end. We've got to both work on that. See, I really think I tried to negotiate a deal where we would make a commitment to the Democrats that, a process where after a required period of time, nominees would automatically be reported out of judiciary. We didn't quite get that agreed to because we couldn't get the leadership to sit down and work up a package. But it was one of the things, a part of the process that led to the compromise agreement or the deal that was worked out with by the so-called Gang of 14. I think that the dynamics in the Senate did change with that, and it is going to be less likely that the judicial nominations will be filibustered or held up in committee in the future. I hope we've argued and fought over that enough. It was beginning to affect everything else we needed to do.
Senator Trent Lott will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called Herding Cats. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including masterpieces of Western music, classics from the Baroque to the modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Senator Trent Lott talks about his back channel relationship with President Clinton and his role in the Senate impeachment trial. Also, David Bianculli reviews the new DVD box set of Dick Cavett's interviews with rock stars, originally broadcast in the late 60s and early 70s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Trent Lott, Republican senator from Mississippi, the former House and Senate whip, and former Senate majority leader. He's written a new memoir about his more than three decades in Congress called Herding Cats. Let's look at something you were involved with a few years ago that you write about in your book. And this was when you established a kind of, should we call it a semi-secret channel with President Clinton when you were a majority leader in the Senate? Semi-secret, does that sound about right?
Yeah, semi-secret, not always a secret, and nothing particularly sinister about it, but the fact of the matter was You know, there were some people in his administration and in the White House and in the Democratic leadership that probably would have been a little uncomfortable knowing how much President Clinton and I talked and worked together.
No, this is the same, true for me.
That, you know, some of my Republican colleagues, as they learned more about it, were not real totally comfortable with that. They were, you know, they really thought that, well, look, you should be much more of an adversary. But here's my viewpoint, and this is my viewpoint of my life in politics. I didn't go to Washington to make a statement. I went to Washington to try to make a difference. Bill Clinton was president of the United States. I was majority leader of the Senate. He couldn't get any bills to sign unless I helped make it possible. And I couldn't get anything passed into law without his signature. We had to work together. I don't think that was unseemly, but we did try to set up a process where we could communicate directly and indirectly, and that we could produce results, which we did.
Now, it's interesting. You established this with the help of Dick Morris. Dick Morris had been a political advisor to you and to President Clinton. I hadn't realized he'd worked with you before working with President Clinton. What did he do to help bring you both together?
He had worked for candidate Clinton for governor of Arkansas, and then he was not with him when he got defeated for re-election as governor, and then he worked with him again when he was elected, and then he sort of gravitated after that to working for Republicans and worked in a Democratic candidate campaign for governor in my state, and eventually wound up in my office and worked in my campaign when I ran for the Senate in 1988. I found him to be a brilliant political thinker. Sometimes the things he suggests go too far, in my opinion. You got to know how to say, no, I'm not going to do that, Dick. But he also had some marvelous ideas of how to convey your message and deal with elections. So he had worked with both of us. And then after working with me, to my somewhat discomfort, which I acknowledge in the book, he was lured back to work for President Clinton when he was in trouble, coming up on his own reelection effort. After that was over, Dick was the first one that finally hit upon the idea, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, I can talk to you, I can talk to Clinton, sometime maybe when y'all can't even talk to each other, and, you know, we get some things done. And we did. You know, we got clean drinking water. We got portable life insurance, welfare reform, immigration reform, balanced budget, tax relief. What we did working together in the summer and the fall of 1996 was one of the better runs of legislative production that I've seen in the years that I've been in Washington.
So what was the communications link that you established?
Well, we did talk directly more than I had thought that we would. You know, the phone was always open. He was good about taking calls, and he would call me. And then, of course, when we start dealing with issues that sometime was a little bit uncomfortable to me or to him, like in the case of welfare reform and also on immigration reform, Dick was always in there trying to sort of saying, well, no, wait, maybe, you know, in order to get the bigger picture done, you may have to concede a little bit here. He was talking to both of us around the margins of what we needed to do to produce a result.
You describe President Clinton as the oddest president you've known?
Well, I don't mean that in necessarily a derogatory way. He would call at strange hours. I thought that was, you know, a little different, late at night or even early in the morning. He did want to get things done, but he always nibbled around the edges of them. I mean, he really did get into the details of legislation. Most presidents have a vision or grand design. Okay, I want some action in this area. Now you go hammer out the legislative details. And President Clinton really got into the details of some of that legislation. And then has been as brilliant as he was in many respects, that to have the personal problems he had, a shame in a way, and really, I guess I don't know what the right word is. Somewhat surprising, but just an unusual person with a tremendous appetite for knowledge and action. I had respect for him in certain areas, and of course, I was very disappointed, like a lot of other people, in what happened with the Monica Lewinsky matter.
When the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton started, what kind of position did you feel in? Because after all, you had developed what sounds like a pretty good communications link with the president, and you feel like you got a lot done, that you managed to come together in spite of your differences and pass legislation. So were you enthusiastic about going forward with a process that would have impeached him? Did you feel in an awkward spot?
I don't know that I felt in an awkward spot. I took it very seriously. When you start talking about impeaching and trying a president of the United States, that certainly is a very, very serious matter, and I took it that way. But I didn't dwell on, where we were, or woe is me, and, all of the personal ramifications. I had a job to do. I had a constitutional role to fulfill. Once the House took the action they did, I thought the Senate had to go forward with it, but I wanted us to do it in a way that was dignified, that took it seriously, did what we had to do, but got it done in a reasonable period of time, and try to do it in such a way that at the back end we could go back to legislating. But that's what I was talking about when I was saying it was kind of an odd arrangement. After the impeachment thing got underway, obviously I didn't talk directly to him. The communication kind of dropped off. He never criticized me or raised a lot of questions about it, either before it got going, during the process, or even after. Within a few days after the Senate voted on impeaching him or removing from office, we started back to work on a legislative process, and it was almost like it had never happened.
You say in your book that you didn't want the Senate to proceed in the same way that the House did with impeachment. What did you find disturbing about how the House had proceeded?
I watched the debate and watched it evolve in the House. Obviously, I'm very fond of the House, and I was very fond of the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Henry Hyde, and many of the managers. But the degree of acrimony was very high, and I think that there was kind of a sense that the House was determined to do it and sort of pushed it right through. Maybe they had to do that. I was not a member of the House, but I did want us to do our job without it becoming, unseemly. There were those that wanted us to put Monica Lewinsky in the well of the United States Senate and question her. I just could not envision that. I just thought that that would have been a mark, frankly, on the Senate. I want us to be careful how we handle it. We did have her questioned. She was subpoenaed, and we had senators that were lawyers question her. Maybe that didn't work out as maybe it should have, but I just wanted people to feel like when it was over, the Senate did its job, did it well on both sides, and came to a conclusion and then moved on.
Do you feel in retrospect that Congress became too tied up with the impeachment at a time when we now know the Clinton administration was trying to go after bin Laden, and when terrorism was really emerging as a serious threat? Do you feel that the country took its eye off the ball and got so completely caught up with the impeachment?
I have several reactions to that. First of all, I don't think we had any choice but to go forward with the investigation. I was, there's no question in my mind he had acted improperly, both personally but also in his testimony before the grand jury. So I don't want to belittle or diminish what, had happened and the need for the Senate to address it. Some people say, it was just about sex. It was also about, how he testified before the grand jury. And also, at that same time, I was concerned about what was being done in terms of taking actions against bombing Iraq, and then I was concerned about, in some instances, actions that were not occurring with regard to bin Laden, for instance. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't tell the uncertainty and the refusal to act sometime. In fact, I publicly supported an action, you recall, one summer when we bombed a facility, and I think it was in the Sudan, and some tents in Afghanistan. I was briefed repeatedly by the CIA and Sandy Berger, these plants are producing precursors to chemical weapons. I went along with it, said yes, I thought there was enough evidence to justify it, but when I look back on it, gosh, did I do the right thing? So that's, again, a case where I thought that their conduct was hard to keep up with, hard to understand. Why weren't they doing more here, less there? And I was troubled by all of that, but I was trying to be helpful where I could, because when it comes to foreign policy and international relations, I do think that the leaders of Congress should try to work with the presidents of either party. And I tried to work with President Clinton and try to have our government speak with one voice when it involved the military or intelligence actions.
My guest is Senator Trent Lott. His new memoir is called Herding Cats. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Trent Lott. He has a new book called Herding Cats, A Life in Politics. When you first came to Congress, it was about the time that there would be a possible impeachment of President Nixon, and you served on the Judiciary Committee investigating that. Did that experience leave you more cynical about politics and presidents than you expected you would be?
I don't think I'd use the word cynical. I'm still not cynical about a life involved in politics as an aide, as a congressman, a senator, in leadership positions. I get disappointed in people and individuals and institutions, but I don't think cynical describes how I feel. Now, remember, and when this was going on during 1973-74, I was a first-term congressman. I was 32, 33 years old, young lawyer from Pascagoula, Mississippi. I was stunned that I woke up and found myself sitting on the Judiciary Committee with 36 or so lawyers considering the impeachment of Richard Nixon, a president that I had been supportive of. And he was, I guess, one of the reasons why I chose to run as I did in 1972 as a Republican. I was really shocked by all of that and was one of the so-called hardheads because I defended the president at every opportunity. You know, they wanted to impeach him for bombing Cambodia. I thought that was very questionable. They wanted to impeach him because he had taken a tax deduction for giving his papers. I had actually worked on that for my predecessor and knew that the law allowed that. But I must say that then when the smoking gun was shown to me, I did announce that I would have voted for one article of impeachment, obstruction of justice. That was an extremely difficult thing for me. And I found when it was all over that I was actually physically and emotionally drained, and it took me till Christmas of that year to get over it. I was really worried that the presidency was in danger, and I didn't know how it would play out. But it was what came out of that actually is one of the reasons why I'm not cynical. Gerry Ford became president, and I will never forget. He got up and he made that speech to the joint session saying, "I'm not a Lincoln, I'm just a Ford, and I'm going to do the best I can." And I think he did a lot to kind of get us back on track and heal the country, even though you could say when he gave the pardon, he guaranteed his own defeat. You could argue the merits of that back and forth. But what it showed me is our system is stronger than any one man or woman. And while people make mistakes, and you can disagree about what should be done with them, that too passed, and we moved on. And in some ways, maybe we were stronger. So I began my career sitting on the Judiciary Committee in hearings on a possible impeachment of Richard Nixon. And then after 30 years, lo and behold, I'm presiding over the Senate during the impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. I've seen a lot in those two processes and everything that went on between the two.
Were you surprised to learn that Deep Throat was Mark Felt?
I didn't have any idea who it might be. I guess now that I know who it was, I'm not particularly surprised. I had theories over the years. I always thought it really was no one person. I thought it was probably sort of a collage or combination of information they got from all kinds of people, and they just developed the combination became Deep Throat. But, coming out of the FBI, you know, it makes sense that that's where the person maybe was that was giving them some of the information they were getting.
We only have a few seconds left, so here's my final very tough question for you. Nearly every article about you, about your personality, as opposed to just like your politics, talks about how neat you are, how neat your office is, how neat your suits and your hair and all, you know. So do you think that your neatness has affected your political style?
Perhaps so. You know, I've always been a little bit of a neatnik. I was an only child. I was always told before you go to school, you're going to make up your bed, clean up your room, get the coal for the fire when we were heating our house by coal, and carrying out the slop jar. And, you know, I had my roles and responsibilities. I was always taught to be organized and, you know, that you could do more. And so that's the way I keep a clean desk. Of course, my staff says, yeah, he keeps a clean desk. It's all on my desk. But I just always felt that, you can tell a lot about a person by their own, decorum and how they handle themselves. And I don't know, some people think it's odd that you put your socks in a drawer by color. To me, it just always made sense. I like organization. I like for things to be thought about, lined up, and a process and a conclusion. And that's the way I tried to run the Senate, which was a new thing, by the way. The Senate was not given to wanting to move along. And some people said, Trent Lott's more obsessed with the process of moving the trains than he is of what's on the train. And, maybe there's some merit to that.
Senator Lott, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you very much, Terry.
Senator Trent Lott's new memoir is called Herding Cats, A Life in Politics. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new DVD collection of Dick Cavett's interviews with rock stars. This is Fresh Air. The first of several planned DVD box sets compiling various episodes from The Dick Cavett Show has been released. The first volume is built around rock stars of the era being 1969 to 75, and it includes full-length performances by Janis Joplin, The Jefferson Airplane, Stevie Wonder, Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, and others. But TV critic David Bianculli says the real treasure in these vintage talk shows isn't just in the music, it's in the talk.
That's Grace Slick and Jefferson Airplane singing the hippie anthem We Can Be Together on the August 19, 1969 edition of The Dick Cavett Show. It's the first salvo on a three-disc DVD just released by Shout Factory. And other full-length songs performed on these shows include Get It While You Can by Janis Joplin, American Tune by Paul Simon, Chelsea Morning by Joni Mitchell, and Thank You for Letting Me Be Myself Again by Sly and the Family Stone. The music is wonderful, but it's the history that's even more potent here. In 1969, Dick Cavett was one of the first serious challengers to Johnny Carson's late-night throne on The Tonight Show. Like everyone else, Cavett didn't make a dent and didn't last long. He eventually took his act to morning TV and primetime and PBS. anywhere that would nurture, however briefly, his taste for lengthy, unplanned conversations with a true variety of celebrities and newsmakers. In the 60s, Cavett was younger than the other talk show hosts, and it was a time, pre-cable, pre-Saturday Night Live, when young people, in the midst of a cultural revolution, didn't have much access to TV. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, the most political show on mainstream television, had just been yanked off the air by CBS, and rock acts like Jefferson Airplane, who had appeared there, had few places to go. Dick Cavett became one of those places. The August 19, 1969 Cavett show that opens the set is full of raw, fresh history. It was taped in early afternoon, a few hours after Jimi Hendrix brought the house down and the sun up as the closing act at a three-day music fair known as Woodstock. The Cavett people, planning ahead, had scheduled a Woodstock post-mortem show for that very day and booked Hendrix as a headliner. He was in no shape to show, but look who did. Jefferson Airplane showed up and kicked things off with We Can Be Together. It was a song that wouldn't be released for a few more months, so ABC's censors weren't paying attention to catch that Grace Slick sang not only the F word, but the longer, rarer MF word as part of the incendiary lyrics. They're all here as part of the show. So is Joni Mitchell, whose manager made her skip Woodstock so she wouldn't miss the Cavett show. She made up for it eventually by writing and singing the song Woodstock about the festival she'd missed. Also on this show, just popping by and performing impromptu, are Stephen Stills and David Crosby, fresh from Woodstock itself. Well, not so fresh. Stephen Stills proudly displays all the mud that was caked on his jeans. Just imagine today how much those jeans would fetch on eBay. The DVD package is indexed so you can hop effortlessly from song to song on each disc. But if you do that, you're missing the interviews and the other guests that share the airtime with these 60s rock icons. And that's much more than half the fun. Cavett, while young enough to be peers with many of these performers, doesn't always know how to relate to them. Sometimes his questions are so strange, even when they're intended sincerely, they're funny in their own way. My favorite is when he asks Janis Joplin about her interests other than music. This is a direct quote. "What else really gives you pleasure? Do you snorkel?" 3 entire hours are devoted to Janis Joplin. The last was recorded in August 1970, just 3 months before her death. The first, in 1969, has her gamely taking a role in a skit with the improv troupe The Committee. And the middle one, the best one of all, pairs her with fellow talk show guests Chet Huntley, the soon-to-retire serious half of the Huntley-Brinkley Report anchor team on NBC, and Raquel Welch, the sex symbol whose infamous Myra Breckinridge movie had just staged its grand opening in Hollywood. What in the world would these three people have to talk about? For one thing, it turned out Janis Joplin had attended the opening of Myra Breckinridge. She even understood, better than Raquel did, the significance of a T-shirt Raquel was wearing during part of her publicity tour for that film.
"And yesterday when I walked down the street, I wore one of those pop T-shirts, you know, that everyone's selling with the comic strip things on, things.
Art Crumb.
And some of them say, 'Keep on trucking.' And
yeah,
mine said,
Art Crumb. It's Art Crumb.
Yeah.
He's great.
And mine said, 'Pow,' across the here.
And, oh.
And I just went to have my picture taken at, I guess it's the Daily News, is it, in New York? And
I
the man
would guess.
Kept saying, listen, could you, over the shoulder, maybe. And I said, 'What is it? What is it? I mean, everyone's wearing these T-shirts. I mean, everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a new thing.'
Probably yours looked
said,
like
well,
everyone
what does
was
it
wearing
mean?
It.
That, to me, is bizarre, priceless television. Raquel Welch and Janis Joplin talking about underground cartoonist R. Crumb. And even more amazing, from that same show, is how Chet Huntley, in 1970, replies to a question asked by Cavett about his personal politics.
"You know, your leaving will unbalance the news world in one sense, because you're known to be conservative on some things that your colleagues are not. What are some of those?"
"Well, you mean these labels
yeah.
that get thrown
yeah.
around? They're unfortunate, because I look at myself and I don't know what I am in terms of conservative and liberal. Mm-hmm. I suppose economically I'm an arch-conservative. My attitudes toward the federal government, the federal structure, I'm disenchanted like so many other Americans with that. It's getting too big and cumbersome and unmanageable. filled with self-serving and self-perpetuating bureaucracy and accomplishes too little for our money. In terms of humanity, in terms of human beings and the racial issue, I suppose I'm a screaming liberal. In terms of conservation of our natural resources, now here we get into the ultimate confusion. Conservation, conservatism, coming from the same root word. What are you if you believe in the conservation of our natural resources? Are you liberal or conservative? I don't know. So we get into terrible confusion here with these words.
He may as well have been talking about red states and blue states. And he was doing it 35 years ago, and given the time to make his point in full. That's what I love most about this DVD set, and why it's definitely worth watching and owning. Good night, Chet.
Good night, David. David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lucifer Shadow, a novel of passion and danger set in Venice by David Hewson, author of The Villa of Mysteries. And from TIAA Cref, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A woman soldier has to toughen herself up, says Kayla Williams, to deal with the enemy and the nervy, hyped-up, and horny guys she's working with. On the next Fresh Air, Williams discusses her new memoir about being a young female soldier in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.